Welcome to Crossroads, a podcast that explores the intersection of faith and Christian living. Crossroads is part of the media ministry at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. Get to know us by visiting us online at fapc.org.
Welcome, folks, to Crossroads Podcast. I'm Jamie Staley. This fall in our series, we are talking about faith and leadership. Our sermon series for the fall, Give Us a King, is going through the book of 1 Samuel to talk about a time when Israel was looking for new leadership, a king. And so we're paralleling that this fall with talking about leadership and faith and how those two places intersect in modern life, in modern characters. Today, I'm really thrilled to be joined by Dr. Anne Marie Mingo, who is an associate professor of ethics, culture, and moral leadership, and the director of the Metro Urban Institute at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Her research interests include 20th and 21st century Black freedom struggles, with a specific focus on the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, South African Apartheid Movement, and the Global Movement for Black Lives, socio-religious activism of Black women, and theological and ethical influences in social movements. I stumbled across her book recently, her first book, Have You Got Good Religion? Black Women's Faith, Courage, and Moral Leadership in the Civil Rights Movement, which was published this year, and just found it so interesting and immediately thought that this was someone that I needed to talk to about this faith and leadership aspect for our podcast. So welcome, Dr. Mingo. I'm so thrilled to be chatting with you today.
Thank you, Jamie. It's great to be here with you.
So let's just dive right in. What, I love hearing that this is really your interest, this studying the civil rights movement. Can you tell me a little bit about how you became interested in this?
So that's a great question. Thanks for asking. Actually, I start out my book describing a part of this. And my interest really is centered in some experiences that I had growing up as a child with my mother telling me things that she did when she was younger. Younger is always relative. But when she was an early college student in Tallahassee, Florida, and how she was participating in some of the sit-in movements. And I'm like, what? Really? And so she would also describe how she and her older sister would go and sit in Tallahassee, Florida, and they were always looking over their shoulder, not so much afraid of the sort of white retaliation that might come from them trying to make this space of this claim of space and this right to be there. But more so, they were afraid that their neighbors might see them and tell their mom, because my grandmother had said, don't go. And my grandmother did not play around. So they were more afraid of that than anything else. And yet they still did it anyway. And it was that, and yet they still did it anyway, that always stuck with me, even as a young person. And so then fast forward many years later, I've always had an interest in history. It's what my parents have always anchored us in. But as I finally left the corporate world, went to seminary, and then began to pursue my PhD at Emory University, I went with a different project in mind. But in my first year, first semester, I wrote a paper about the martyrs of the movement. And I was looking at women and children who were often not recognized, often not paid attention to, because we had the larger names of the Martin Luther King Jr.'s and the John Lewis's and the Andrew Young's and the C.T. Vivian's. But I always kept saying, look at any picture. Look at any picture from the movement, and you see all of these young people and all of these women. And I just wanted to know, who are they? What pushed them out there, and what kept them out there? Why did they do it anyway, to the point of like my mother? So that's what sort of brings me to this. It's always been an interest. I've always loved history. But as I started thinking through moral movements and moral formation and ethical engagement, this was a great place to see the faith and the activism coming together to lead to the results that we have had for a while and that we need to fight for again today.
Thank you for that. And, you know, right in the middle of that, you actually got to my next question, which was, what did you find in your research to be the most compelling motivation for these Black church women to risk their lives, to be doing it anyway?
Yeah. So actually, in the book, I describe this ethic as something that they had to do, because in interview after interview, so I interviewed well over 40 women who self-identified as being active in the civil rights movement, and I found them in Black churches, AME churches predominantly, you know, the predominantly Black Methodist denomination, and National Baptist Church is one of the predominantly Black Baptist denominations. These women, as they were self-identifying, and I'm interviewing them individually in the North and in the South, they almost all word for word said, it was just something I had to do. Well, it was just something I had to do. Well, I wanted things to be better, so I just had to do it. And so a part of this for them is this understanding who they were. They were listening to the sermons of the pastors. They were reading the Bible themselves. And so today I would use the Imago Dei language, recognizing that they could see themselves in the image of God and could not imagine how they wouldn't be able to have the same rights as anybody else. And so they very often, unlike their parents, decided, we're going to act out whatever it takes to allow us to live as fully as possible. And so within an ethical framework, I might look at this as human flourishing. But as I think of it from a biblical standpoint of what these women would have been wrestling with, this is that life and life more abundantly that Jesus has come that we might have. And that's what they were seeking. How is it that I can actually live in a life that is more abundant if all of these systems and structures are trying to limit it? I must change those systems and structures so that we can actually live.
That's so important. So when you think of these stories that you heard, there was so many. What were a couple of your favorite or most interesting stories that you had from your research that highlighted, I guess, kind of that leadership or imagination of what the world could be kind of a aspect?
There were a lot. The book only features a few. And so there are other mm-hmm. stories that are still, you know, sort of running around in my head. But I tried to do my best to do some of the stories that could illustrate best this sort mm-hmm. of connection between faith and leadership, et cetera. The first thing that was coming to mind when you were asking the question, though, Jamie, is a story about Marjorie Wallace Smith, who mm-hmm. is a woman who currently lives in New York City, but she was born and raised in that Birmingham, Alabama area. And she describes in language that is very powerful, her own sort of theological awakening as a 5 or 6 year old. As she's walking past her church on her way, as she says, to church school, and she walks past another white church. And the young people that are playing outside begin to call her names, horrible names, all of these derogatory things. And so she began to question, well, do they pray to the same God? How could they pray to the same God if this is what they are doing? And so she asked her father, she was like, this isn't what we're being taught in church. They must have a different God than we have. But it was that type of questioning that led her to then not simply take on, you know, a form of Christianity that would not be liberative and that would not be rooted in love. And so her leadership, even today, like when I was conducting the interview with her, and it's interesting because I've seen her recently. I've seen her like within the last couple of months. So she's still out wow. doing a lot of stuff. But when I was interviewing her for what shows up in the book, I'm in this little small room I interviewed her a couple of times, but for the first time, I'm in this little small room, and it was the dressing room for the choir people. It's like the choir room. Because right outside of there, she was organizing some back to school things for young people. So she's putting together these 600 backpacks or something that they were doing. It's that same thing that the church, she believes that the church should be doing things that are rooted in liberation and love. And you show mm-hmm. that by doing the actions towards young people that will help them to see God in themselves and others, et cetera. So it all gets shaped for her as this 5-6 year old. Walking to church and then beginning to question, well, if that's what's coming out of that church, something must be wrong. And if you fast forward mm-hmm. now to the efforts that she continues to do, it is to have a consistent witness coming out of her church that represents love and justice and all of the other types of things.
What
a powerful story. When you were doing your research, what were some of the unique challenges that you saw that women, Black church women, were facing that compared to their male counterparts in the civil rights movement? And I guess the second part of that question is, did you see faith as a way that they navigated those, or what did you find there?
Yeah, so one of the things that for me is interesting is that for the most part, I knew when I was doing these interviews that I was chasing the clock, because many of the women were getting older and I might not have an opportunity to talk to them again. But if you think about the language of church women, the people that were already older during the movement, I had already missed many of them. So most of the women that I was interviewing, they were teenagers during the movement. And so then some 50, 60 years later, as I'm interviewing them, they were then in their 70s, et cetera, right? So I just want to give some caveat around that. Because they were younger as they were making their faith expressions. And very often when they had been, and they and the women that they were around, because I think about a Bernice Johnson Reagan, who, you know, has just recently transitioned and had been one of the leaders, one of the founders of the SNCC Freedom Singers. And she comes out of that Albany, Georgia area. Her father had been a pastor. She'd been in a church her whole life. She had been singing in the church her whole life. But she describes that she had never seen women up in the pulpit. Unless it was, you know, to be able to sing a song or something like that. And every now and then, even if it was a women's day, they were supposed to speak from the floor. But she then began to describe seeing people like a Fannie Lou Hamer in the pulpit during the movement. Because so much of what was happening in those smaller areas during the movement, it was more about who's actually doing the work than some of the other hierarchies. And so we get a chance to see some shifting that starts happening during the civil rights movement for women's leadership, but not as pastors. And so that's one of the things that becomes a differing piece for the younger folks. Because again, they're out there risking their lives, so they can't understand why somebody can't be up there also speaking, teaching, preaching, whatever. This is one of the things that's coming to me, because very often they didn't necessarily have the models of what religious leadership could look like, because so much of that had been male dominated. But in the movement, you get to see women moving into a different position and a different role. Now, again, very often they were not up as the preachers, but they could get up and speak and tell about what had happened to them that week, and they would interweave scriptures into it. And so we've got some speeches of like the Fannie Lou Hamers, et cetera. And if you were to read them, there's scripture all throughout. But she's speaking. She's not preaching, quote unquote, right? She's speaking. And so it's this way of sort of shifting the power dynamic. And one of the other areas where that was often happening for the women is that, again, if you are being restricted from the pulpit as that place of power, that place of leadership for religious formation, et cetera, you still had access, at least in the civil rights movement time period, to the way that the mass meetings were structured, where there was a lot of singing within them. And so women would lift up lyrics of songs. They weren't passing around hymnals to say, okay, we're going to sing from page 272. They would lift up songs within the congregation. And if you listen to, which is some of the stuff that I've been able to analyze, if you listen to some of the recordings taken from that time period that are still held by the Smithsonian and other spaces, you will hear women's voices lifting lyrics of songs. And as they are doing that, they're constructing the song in the moment, and that gets to reveal for us their own theological understanding. Walk with me, Lord, walk with me, hold my hand, be my friend, speak to me, hold my heart. All of these things, they're beginning to say what they believe God is doing and can do through the lyrics that they're making in the moment. And then others, in a call and response way that happens in so many African contexts, they are lifting and repeating back what these women are lifting as their sort of theological foundations for the movement.
Was there a divide at all between kind of this, I guess, less formal when women were speaking versus the preaching that men are allowed to do? Kind of a divide within the movement, or did everyone, was it pretty well meshed as far as faith and leadership, women and men within that.
Say that we see some differences happen as the movement makes its way along the way, right? So if we think about the traditional time period of the civil rights movement, we generally would start it around 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education decision from the Supreme Court, and we would take it to about 1968, King's assassination, civil rights legislation going through. So as you're moving along that spectrum towards this sort of, within this 14-year period, by 1960, when we see the formation of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that's when we see quite a bit of the changes in power dynamics amongst genders, because these are younger people who are, you know, who have already been resisting the hierarchical structure of the NAACP, of the student, of SCLC, of CORE, et cetera. And so as SNCC is forming under the leadership and advisement of an Ella Baker, who has this idea of participatory democracy, which is a much more flat space, then you see a lot more of the women and the men in a more balanced way. But SNCC is not, quote unquote, a religious organization. And yet in their founding documents, there's a lot of scripture. There's a lot of stuff around the Bible.
So last month, I chatted with Dr. Tobin Shearer, who's out of the University of Montana, and we talked about how religious movements or how religion has been used in social protest movements as a whole in general. And we talked a lot about the water protectors in South Dakota. And we spent some time talking about the kind of clash between those folks who were interested in including religious aspects in the protest movement and those who really didn't want to include religious aspects. Did that happen at all within where you saw within women in the civil rights movement?
Yes and no. I was specifically looking for Black religious women. So my whole focus was to understand how their understanding of God was influencing their action. So I wasn't looking for people who did not have some connection. I was intentionally only interviewing folks who were there. Right. So I just want to give that as the main part of the caveat. And with that said, even in the interviews with some of these women who, again, had been active some 50 years earlier, they were describing some time periods where they would walk away from the faith with all that they were seeing. You know, just imagine you're believing all of this and your friend just got murdered. Right. You're believing all of this and you're constantly being attacked by others who are also professing the same faith. It can make you question. Right. And so some of the women were describing seeking other things, right? So there was one woman who described, she said, well, I was looking at Buddhism for a little while. She said, I considered, Judaism for a little bit, wasn't sure how that was going to fit. There's another woman who I was interviewing who was preparing at the moment. Well, at the time that Malcolm X was assassinated, at that time he was El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. At the time that he was assassinated, she was getting dressed to go and join his movement. And she received a call from her sister to say, hey, they just killed him. And so I say that because there was this searching for a different type of understanding of faith that could allow them to keep trying to live out the life as best as they could. That's one part. The other thing that I often try to help people understand is that broadly across the civil rights movement, the majority of people were not actively involved. I've never seen numbers over 25 or so percent max, which means that the overwhelming majority of people were not actively involved. Is that because they were not faith people? I don't know. I doubt it. Right. So we don't know what that was. There's a lot of fear that's associated with it. We've got the beauty and the power to reflect back now some 50, 60 years to see what the result was going to be. But in the moment, day after day, they don't know they're going to be victorious. And so it was a risk to step out, which is why I really wanted to understand what was it about these women who did make that choice to go out day after day, not knowing from day one to day whatever that they would actually be successful as they might deem it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what would you say they brought to the movement that was different than other either secular folks who didn't include their faith within it or men? What was it that these Black church women brought to the movement that was unique?
Yeah. One of the things I'm thinking about, a story from a woman. She was a teenager at the time. She was in New Jersey, in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And she talks about how her pastor would often preach to them and say, you know, God is going to be doing some of this stuff, but we have to do our part too. And so she, as this, you know, teenager, she was in high school and she's out protesting and sitting in the middle of the street and blocking things. And she understood that to be her following what her pastor had been saying, to go out. So even though her mother, her grandmother, her aunt, none of them would, she did, because she was listening to those sermons and understood that as their work, as their sort of God-led work to be out there. And so that's one example, but you also hear it, and I don't want to say it too often, but I kind of have to. You hear it in the music. You hear it in the songs that they were singing and that they were constructing in the moment, because that was a part of, that was the one space. They weren't necessarily writing and getting things published in the same way to sort of state their claim, but they were able to sing it out. And that's one of the things, a lot of the songs that we do have today that we've been able to sort of maintain as a part of the civil rights movement, they were written by women, those that we have attributions to. And so we get to see that their faith shows up in the music that kept them going in the movement. That comes from somewhere. I didn't get to interview everybody to see, how is it, ma'am, that you were able to write this song in the middle of this? But I can look at the lyrics of the song. I can understand the origin of the roots of the song, that it came out of a spiritual that they just then created new words for, right? So, Oh Mary, Oh Martha, the spiritual, which has shown up, you can go and pull that from some of the slave narrative songs that have been captured, becomes Oh Pritchett, Oh Kelly, open them jails, right? So, Oh Mary, Oh Martha, ring them bells becomes Oh Pritchett, Oh Carey, open them jails. It's particular to that part of Georgia where she was operating, but it comes through this longer lineage of spiritual music that has come out of struggle. So from the period of enslavement with the spirituals to the labor movement to the civil rights movement, there is a line that connects their theology through their music. And these women were pulling from that stuff that existed and then just sort of reforming it so that it could have something to say in their current moment.
So the answer to my next question may be songs again. And this is more of just your own opinion on this. How do you see folks emulating and saying that what they did was a great way to do it? How do you see that happening today?
Yeah, there are a lot of lessons that we're able to learn today from some of the things that the women did in the movement. In my book, I actually try to do what you're asking in the fifth chapter, which is where I'm looking at a theology for social movements, and I'm interviewing women who are active or who have been active in what we would consider now the movement for Black Lives, or the Black Lives Matter movement. And so there are parallels that I can see across those two generations of women, black religious women activists. And so the songs, it does remain something, right? So they are reappropriating songs in a way that can speak, but they are also taking chants and things like that and figuring out, so what's the language? This was a chant that would happen before, chants around freedom. And so what's the chant for now, right? They're taking a particular use for scripture. And so when I was doing the interviews with the women from the civil rights movement time period, I was asking them, tell me a scripture that reminds you of the movement and why. Found it very interesting that none of them were giving the things that we might traditionally think about for Black liberation theology. So none of them were talking about Exodus. None of them were talking about apocalyptic type scriptures. They were all referencing primarily scriptures of God being with you in the midst of the struggle, not necessarily God taking you out of it. And so when I look at some of the scriptures that the women today were looking at and referencing, it was moving even to the next level. God, fix me in the midst of this so that I can keep doing this, right? Give me a different orientation as to who I am and where I am so that I can keep pressing out. And so there are things that we now have where many of the women during the civil rights movement had to sort of do this this reorientation of space that was happening then, of I'm going to make my way into the pulpit by leading this song, but while I'm there, I'm going to drop some scriptures and I'm going to sneak in a little testimony, right? Versus today, where we have the women who are actually pastors and they can actually structure their sermons, their Bible studies, put people up to pray, etc., in ways that reinforce again, this Imago Dei, all of this stuff that is a little bit different. But there are definitely parallels across the movements. And one of the things that I found most helpful is when I've been out in community with some of the younger activists, again, around Movement for Black Lives, different activations, they have studied the civil rights movement better than almost anybody that I know. They've read the books. They've been doing the deeper dives so that they could learn the lessons from that time period, make some tweaks and adjustments, and apply what was helpful and then leave behind what was not. And as a result, today we see a lot more concern about mental health and rest as a part of the work, because they've got the wisdom now of looking back on the previous movement and saying, okay, we see what happened there. How can we orient this differently? And then make sure that we have a little bit more to keep going instead of having people burning out, breaking down, et cetera.
Absolutely. You know, I love history, and I am always trying to tell my teenagers who don't love history that it is important to look at our history so that we know what to emulate, so that we know what not to do. You know, and that this is a great example of being able to take people who did a good job in the past and say, let's keep following in their footsteps and add our own, recognize our own, being able to move forward.
So a flyer from before is now a tweet, you know, or a post, but it's the same thing. What's the type of information that they would have had on a flyer that was being hand drawn? And what's the thing that I put on my Instagram post or that I put in whatever else? Right? If these are the mechanisms, what do we learn from the past and then how do we apply it? So I'm glad that you're doing that with your teenagers.
You heard me at the beginning say that our sermon series, and we're kind of talking about this idea that Israel wanted a king and how to have these kings. How did these kings in 2 Samuel and 1 Kings, some of them were good, some of them were really bad, and how their faith played into it. What did you learn from these Black church women about the importance of their faith and how it, if it kept them going? I know you mentioned that some of them had, you know, because they just for their own health needed to move into different areas, but how did their faith propel them and how can it propel us into social activism?
So let me just step back a second and say, for the women who were doing this searching, only one of them actually has become a different faith other than Christian. And so she's Sunni Islam and has been for a long time. She's one of my mentors. She's a, you know, amazing woman, had been a strong leader within the movement, a part of SNCC. And so, but the others, they kind of were looking, but I interviewed them in AME churches. So they were still connected to, you know, a Black Baptist space. I mean, a Black Methodist space. One of the things that I was also trying to, like I keep saying, trying to understand is what did push them out there. And it was always interesting to me when they would tell me the stories about others that were around them that did not go. And so you can think about being a college student and you're going out packing your little toothbrush to go and get arrested, but your roommate is afraid to go. And so they stay back. Right? Or family members. One woman began to describe that she took the family's only tube of toothpaste because she knew she was going to get arrested that day and she wanted to have some toothpaste in jail. Right? But no one else from the family was going to do that. So much of what these women were doing, they weren't concerned about whether or not anybody would remember their name down the road. They weren't concerned about whether or not they'd get recognition. They were doing it because they knew it was the right thing to do. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons that we can take from this, is that we don't worry about if everybody else comes along with us, if we know that this is the right thing to do. Like I mentioned a little bit ago, I've never seen numbers more than 20 or so percent is being active. That means that the overwhelming majority were not. But that also means that you should focus in on those who are. So all you people won't come along with you, that's okay. Get your 20% and go out and change the world. Not quite able to bring everybody else along, that's okay. Work with those who are ready to work with you and go do whatever it is that you can do to help us change the world. That's one of the biggest lessons that I've taken, because they weren't looking to be called leaders. And yet in their actions, they were. And that should matter.
That is powerful. Do what you know is right. Do what you believe is true. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Mingo, for joining me today. Folks, definitely pick up her book. It was a good read, and also just so insightful and a great lesson in history, which, as I just said, I really enjoy. So thank you again, Dr. Mingo, for joining me this month. And thanks, folks at home, for listening.
Thank you for listening to Crossroads. Our managing editor is Jamie Staley, and our editors are Vashina Brisbane and Emily Dombroff.